forth. Somebody from Cody from out the East End there. He's coming here to tile my backsplash tomorrow.
There you go.
Getting recorded live. Choking Hazard 2020, sponsored by nobody.
Why do you keep calling it that? It's not 20. That's just an Instagram hashtag. That's it.
2020, sponsored by nobody, with your hosts Michael Briers and Aaron Gall.
Yeah, co-host.
Tonight,
what's up, Mr. Isaac?
I'm good. Excellent. Yeah, man, perfect. It's been this COVID stuff is really changing our lives, isn't it?
Just a touch, yes. I would believe. How you've been making out over this entire process? You've been okay, or?
Well, I mean, financially, I'm not having any issues. I'm still working. I work for the city, so it's people still have to pick up your garbage, right?
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's great, and my wife's working from home, so. We're good that way. The kids are going stir crazy, but they're getting through it. Matt and I get the odd time to train. Like right now, my back's been killing me, but when I'm healthy, we come out down here in the basement, we roll. So
there you go. So you're ready to rock as soon as this COVID thing is done, and you can get back into setting up your tournaments and setting up it's a sub X again and all that kind of jazz.
Oh, yeah, I can't wait to do a sub-X show, to be honest with you. I don't have the financial ability to do it with no fans.
It'll be very difficult.
I'm not going to do that, but I will wait. But, I mean, I got some plans for the community. We'll see. We're gonna try to make it worth their while to come back and, compete or, go to a seminar. As soon as we can get through the situation of touching each other and rolling, I have some big plans. I got the green light from the board to do a big seminar and bring in some really, not the biggest names in the world, but prominent names that make you want to go and check it out. So
nice.
I got the green light from them as well. So it's in the works, and, we just got to get through this rough patch and get back to rolling so that it can be well supported. Right.
When it's official, send us the information. We'll post it up and everything.
For sure.
Another thing I wanted to ask you, just based on the situation, like what is the, so you're not a gym owner, but you're working with the OJA currently. Tony's one of the board members, for those that don't know. What are some of the things that the OJA is doing, or guidelines, or how are we going to get gyms open again? Like, what's kind of like the step-by-step? We had Crew Brian Edwards on a couple days ago, or we're going to release that in a couple days as well. And he was talking more from like a Muay Thai standpoint, but we wanted to have you on more from like a jiu-jitsu standpoint. How are we going to get the ball rolling again?
Well, what they did back in, I believe it's late May, the government put in an emergency order that included the ability for PSO amateur sports to open, provided that they follow the guidelines that Health Canada puts forth. So meaning if you can find a way to open up and have your athletes, separated, because with martial arts, there's so many different types of martial arts. Like with karate, for instance, if I was running a karate gym and I had to do solo drills, I could have them doing katas, all day. It's not my thing. From my perspective, but from a karate or taekwondo perspective, there's lots of things that they can do that are, listed as a solo drill that can carry them through. And, to be honest with you, with BJJ, if you're trained in gymnastic naturel, you could do that. So, I mean, I think the first step really is they are looking at opening up and doing solo things, which, I'm sure not a lot of people are not comfortable with. We're also thinking about a buddy system that we can do, and starting tomorrow, so what we've done is we've started to create protocols to get back to play. And what we've decided to do, actually, I took this idea from Muay Thai Ontario, is to have a meeting with the registered gyms, because at the end of the day, our organization is there to help them, right? So why not get them involved in creating the protocols, right? So if it's something that they're a part of and they help create, they're more willing to follow it, right? So that's the plan. That we have a meeting tomorrow at 3 p.m. with a whole bunch of the gyms, and then another one on Monday and another one on Wednesday. And then based on those meetings, we can finalize the protocols and then put a green light for jiu-jitsu. I'm hoping maybe July the 6th that we'll be able to open in phase one of our association. So, I mean, phase one, I'm not going to speak for everybody, but I'm just assuming that it's probably going to be along the solo drill situation. And then hopefully, you know, a minimum of 2 weeks have to go by so that we can see if, you know, if it spikes, if cases spike up, then we know, shit, we got to slow down, right? But if we can get through those 2 weeks and not see a spike, then maybe we can go to step two, which would be the buddy system where you train with, you know, the same partner. And now we can start actually training because, you know, you have somebody to work with, right? So, you know, it's been a process. I will say that. But at the end of the day, I totally understand the severity of why we're doing what we're doing. And I'm hoping that the gyms do too, because the last thing we want is for our gym to open and COVID-19 spreads right through that gym and forces him to shut down and, you know, puts all these people in, you know, in a bad position, and it puts a bad taste on jiu-jitsu altogether. So this is something that, you know, we really have to, you know, take seriously. So
when you, obviously being in a position like this, creating the PSO, getting gym owners together to kind of build this plan together, when you start to see, and I know you see it online, the banter online saying, well, I'm just going to open up, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, yeah, train like normal. Like, what goes through your head when you see that kind of stuff? Because some of it seems careless.
And it is careless. I mean, I understand, you know, there's a lot of people who believe that this is overblown, and the way that we're handling it is a little too safe. You know, I don't believe that you can be too safe, but I understand what they mean. Like, you know, like I'll go into some grocery stores and I'll see people getting out of their cars and they got full face shield and gloves and, you know, it looked like they were going into surgery and they're just going to the grocery store. So, I mean, I get it. I understand. I go to the grocery store. The odd time I will wear gloves, but I don't wear a mask. I just stay away from people, you know, like, you know, there's just a certain way you got to carry yourself differently. That's all. But I mean, there is some people that are very paranoid, and maybe some people have, you know, a low immune system. I didn't know this, but if you don't have a spleen, that means your immune system is compromised. And if you were to get something like this, it would be really bad for you because your body doesn't have the ability to shred toxins, right? So, you know, and we don't know everybody's disposition. So, you know, yeah, it is something that, you know, so I when these gyms, you know, say these things and do these things, I know there was a guy out in Alberta who said, I'm going to open up, I don't care, blah, blah, blah. And then we found out a day later that the government spoke to him and now he's not opening. So, you know, at the end of the day, we had two martial art or fitness or type gyms who tried to open up and do an outside thing. And one guy got a warning and the other one got a $10,000 fine. So,
ooh,
I will say this. Hey, man, it's your gym. You do what you want. But, you know, I will say this. The gyms that are registered with us will have a certificate saying that they're registered with us, and they will have the emergency order showing that PSOs are allowed to open. So I'm confident that I think that what will happen when we do open is we will be challenged by the government. And because, you know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. And usually complaints are put in because people complain that they're open. So, you know, I believe that we will see some backlash, but at the same time, we're preparing ourselves for it. So for those gyms who do open and don't have that credibility, I don't know how they're going to, you know, sway the government away from them. But, you know, hey, if they can open up and, you know, be successful, all the power to them. But, you know, I would rather not have any, you know, trouble, you know.
No, I feel you 100%. So, like, how did you originally get, like, put in, like, onto the position of the board? Was this something that you kind of, like, elected yourself into, or was it, it was?
Well, I originally started doing jiu-jitsu in, maybe 1998. I was introduced to it, and at the time, I was still, like, you know, I was still a kickboxer at the time, and, but I ventured it. I wanted to check it out, and I joined up for that year, and then I, you know, and then of course I veered away from it. I suffered a neck injury, had to have neck surgery, and then I get a call in 2001 from Danny, and said, "Hey, I'm looking for a kickboxing instructor. Do you think you can come in and teach for me?" And it was kind of like at the time I was, you know, healing from my neck surgery, and I felt like a bum, and I was like, "Man, this is my way out. This is my way to, you know, get back into shape." And so I started doing that, and that's how I kind of, I would go and teach kickboxing every day, and I would watch the guys do jiu-jitsu after thinking, "Oh, I can't do that." And that bothered me for about a year and a half. I taught for Danny, and then finally, I think it was in the fall of 2002, I said, "You know, Danny, get me a gi. I'm going to try this jiu-jitsu stuff again." And he was like, "You sure?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm sure." And I think I went full bore January 2003. I just started going full bore, and 3 months into training, I entered my first tournament, and you know, the rest is history. But going to the tournaments, I saw that there was a need for, the first thing I saw a need for was referees. At that time, the referees were volunteers. They showed up at the tournaments. They volunteered their time. They never got paid. And, you know, I ended up becoming one of those people. I wanted to be the guy who you know, would help the other tournaments. At the time, I wasn't running my own. I wanted to help those guys be successful. So if they needed a ref, I would jump in and referee. And at the time, we were just using universal rules. I can't even remember what the rules were. I don't know if we even used advantages back then. I'm not sure.
Sorry to cut you off, but what year did you start reffing?
2004.
2004, okay. Just for context.
My first tournament, I was 2004, was the Jocelyn tournament. Jeff and his dad, Rick, ran a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu tournament. They ran a karate tournament as well on another day, but we never saw it because we never went to it. But
I think we talked about that tournament when Dan Maroney was on a couple – we recorded that a couple episodes ago.
Yeah, Danny actually used to ref at the time. You had referees like Marco Costa – myself, Jeff Jocelyn would ref. All these guys would referee, because you know it was hard to find people that, you know, hard to find people that were good, and then, you know, find people that were willing to, you know, stay for the journey of an event like the Jocelyn tournament. You know, it was a crazy tournament, but it was a big tournament, and so, you know, it was really long days. I remember one time I finished a refereeing stint in one area of the gym because there was like three areas at the high school that Jeff used to run this tournament. And one of the areas was on the stage in the theater. They had a mat there. So I finished my mat area, and then I was asking, "Where's Jeff?" And they're like, "Yo, he's in the theater." So I went into the theater, and sure enough, Jeff is reffing in the theater. And I'm like, "Man, this guy's running the tournament. He should not be reffing." So I was like, "Dude, what are you doing?" And he goes, "Oh, I'm just reffing here." And I'm like, "I'll take over. Get out of here." And he goes like, "What? What do you mean?" And I go, "You shouldn't be reffing. You're running the tournament, man. Go shake some hands and kiss babies. Like, get out of here." And he was like, "Oh man, thank you so much." And he went off and you know, of course, had some other things that he needed to get done. But you know, but I reffed. I ended up reffing another 45, 50 minutes in there to get it done and get, you know, all the matches done. And, you know, I think that was kind of like my foot in the door. And then once I did that for a bit, I ran my first tournament in 2005. And that was when I first started to interact with the brass of the Ontario Jiu-Jitsu Association. At the time, Danny was still a board member. And that, you know, because I was running a tournament now, I had to, you know, submit a paperwork and deal with, you know, the all the communications involved in getting ready for an event. And you know, the year before that, the Canadian Jiu-Jitsu Association back then ran, they had a world championships that was held here in Canada. And so I ended up being on the BJJ team. And, you know, believe it or not, I had just got my blue belts and I made the BJJ team. It was kind of funny. But, but anyways, I started to get to know who these people were, and I started to realize that, you know, everybody on this board are from Japanese jiu-jitsu. None of them are from Brazilian jiu-jitsu, but the lion's share of the membership is Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So I'm kind of like, maybe we should have somebody that's Brazilian jiu-jitsu that is involved to, you know, try and help, you know, these guys through it, because, you know, they're not going to really know what their people want. You know what I mean? And at the time, Danny had gotten fed up with the board and resigned from the board. So now there was no BJJ people on the board. So I think after my first tournament that I ran, I got more involved. So I started going to the AGMs that they would have. And I started to really see that, you know, they needed some help. They had some good people, but just some good people that didn't know Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I remember I had after my first tournament, back then we used to do years of experience, novice, intermediate, advanced, like, you know, like a grappling tournament. And I didn't like it. I was like, no, we should have white belt, blue belt, and then purple and up. Well, isn't that the same thing? No, it's not the same thing, because I can have an intermediate blue belt and an intermediate white belt. And I don't want to see in the gi division white belt and blue belt fighting each other. It's just not right. Mm-hmm. And what they said to me was, well, if it ain't broke, why trying to fix it? And I go, see, that's what you don't know. It is broken. You guys are just living with it. And they said, okay, we're going to make it so that it's optional, that they could use belt ranks or they could use years of experience. And I was like, okay, that's fair. I can live with that. And then in 2006, I did the first tournament using belt ranks instead of years of experience. And the numbers just started to skyrocket. Everybody wanted to do Brazilian jiu-jitsu tournaments now, because white belts fought white belts, blue belts fought blue belts, and then purple and up. And it changed everything. And, which was good for the association, because everybody had to be a member to compete. So now what was happening was more people were signing up. They were making more money. And now they just realized that I just put something in there to make them more money, and they didn't even know it. So it was kind of like, okay, now they are starting to trust me a little bit more. And then we started to have a falling out. I wasn't happy, and I wasn't even a board member at the time, but, you know, I just wasn't liking the way things were going. It kind of, the impression that people got was that the OJ was just there to take our money, and they weren't there to help us in any way. And it, you know, to that credit, that's what it looked like. So, we as a BJJ organization or a community decided that we were going to try to open up our own federation, and called the Ontario Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Federation. And of course, if I'm going to do this, I want to get recognized by the government for it. So we went ahead and we got a whole bunch. It was Ricardo Amendola, George Brito, Josh Rapport, Omar Salvosa, Fernando Zulik. We all got together and we went and had sushi at one place one night. And we said, look, this is what we want to do. This is what has to be done to do it. Are we all in? And so in order to open a business name and a bank account, it was going to cost us about $500. So everybody right there on the spot put $100 on the table and said, let's do it. So we did it. We started the organization. I think the first tournament was Omar's tournament. And we just basically said, we're going to walk away. This, and I'm fast forwarding here. I'm talking like,
what year was this? And
this is like 2009 now, right?
Would you say that was kind of like the turning point for like jiu-jitsu in Ontario?
Yeah. So we put a real scare into them, because now all that membership was going to our federation and not theirs. And the government didn't really know what to do. And so I went to the government and I said, look, this is what we want to do. And they came back to us with, jiu-jitsu is jiu-jitsu. I don't care if it's Brazilian or blah, blah, blah. You should all be under one house. And I was like, yeah, that's not going to work. And they said, oh, and then they threw the, well, you could get sued at me, right? And I said, okay, we'll take that up. We'll take that. And so we ran the first tournament, Omar's tournament, and the OJ cried to the government saying, you can't let them do this, blah, blah, blah. They're taking all our money. So she came back to me. She calls me back and says, What if we gave you, this is the government, what if we gave you board spots on the Ontario Jiu-Jitsu Association to govern Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? And we were like, now you're talking, right? So we agreed to close up the federation in exchange for them giving us three legitimate board spots immediately on in the association. And they were, so we said, yes, let's do it. And but she still had to go back to them. And basically, she went to them and they were totally against it. And she came back with, well, if you don't, we'll just pull your PSO. And so it opened up the door for us to go in there. And I'm so glad it happened because I get along with those guys great, you know. They're not bad people. The guy on the guy who is the treasurer and the VP, man, he's got a hard job dealing with managing the money and all that stuff. And I think he does a great job with that. You know, sometimes a little too stingy, but you know, at the end of the day, better too stingy than too loose with the money, right? So, and our president is a great writer. He writes some great stuff. Like a lot of the recent COVID stuff that you see, that's all him, you know. I wouldn't want to, everybody says to me, oh, I should be the president. Man, no, I shouldn't. There's things that these guys do that I just would prefer not to do. So, you know, that's how I got my board spot. And you know, for, I mean, Mike, you know what I do at the tournaments. I kind of like what my job is there and nobody wants my job. So I've been in this position since 2010 and it's 2020. And nobody's even tried to step up to take my position. So
that's it, is what it is right there. That's a challenge.
Yeah.
Tony throwing down the gauntlet.
Yeah.
I think you even mentioned, even in that tournament, see that, I think it's in 2009, you mentioned some big names there. Like those are like you, George Brito, Josh Rapport, Omar Salvosa, Fernando Zulik. That's kind of like the founding fathers of the Ontario Jiu-Jitsu, like.
To be honest with you, it even goes deeper than that. You know, and George Brito came to this scene around 2008. And, you know, mind you, he's been very influential since he's been here. But, you know, the Jiu-Jitsu community goes much farther back than that. It goes far back as if I were to go a little bit farther back, as Wagner Fabiano came here from Brazil and really, you know, brought jiu-jitsu here in a way that, you know, people never seen because he's so high level. You know, you go farther back and you have Sylvain Moruni, Danny's brother, and Monier Zeke were like the two top teams at the time. And, you know, you had a guy named Master Silvio Baring who used to come here a lot back in those days. And share his jiu-jitsu with, you know, you have a prefel of black belts here now in Marco Costa, Monkey, Justin Bruckman, and the list goes on of black belts from that lineage. They were the OGs, man. Like, you know, those guys, I remember, you know, Monkey coming in my gym one day, he was a purple belt and I was like I think I was a second degree blue belt or something like that. And he came into the gym just to train. I think he was working around the corner from our gym. And so every now and then he would have came in to train with us. And, man, what a phenom he was, you know, being like the UCC champ. And you know, so, I mean, like, there's so much history here just with our Canadian brethren. But having said that, I think George Brito brought something here that really changed the game, not just with regards to his jiu-jitsu, but – you know, he had a lot of knowledge on running tournaments and we had to learn a lot of these things on how to do it. We watched a lot of the IBJJF stuff and learned a lot, but I would be lying if I didn't say that, I learned, some nice tricks from watching George Brito's early Toronto Jiu-Jitsu Classic tournaments that he ran, very professional. Like if your eyes were closed, you thought it was an IBJJF tournament, but he was brought up through the IBJJF on how to run events. So, you know, he had a way of doing things and, you know, some things at that time we weren't ready for, but, you know, like, but here we are doing them now, like, you know, online registration. You know, we never used to do that back in the day, you know? But man, how does it make our lives so much more easier, you know? You know, so I think that at that time it made sense to have George Brito be a part of it. And it's not about picking and choosing who was a part. He wanted to be a part of it. He wanted to be involved. So it made sense that we, you know, that he was a part of what we did. And not only that, but if you show that you got people coming in from all different wings of the jiu-jitsu community, things actually go smooth, man. Like, we have our arguments and our beliefs on things, but at least when we're done, everybody's on the same page, and, you know, you can't argue that. And I think that's why our BJJ community today is so huge, is because a lot of the biggest teams, and I will say it, the biggest teams, Hanzo Gracie team, Fernando Zulik's team, Ascension's team, Toronto BJJ Jiu-Jitsu for Life team, Team Novia now, Wagney and his group. These were all, you know, from time to time were big teams, and now the other teams emerging, like, you know, Marco Costa's Body of Four team is getting pretty darn big. So, I mean, like, it's great to see this jiu-jitsu community be like this. And then what happens is when all these big teams are all on the same page, all the smaller teams just straggle along and jump in. And, you know, that's how you get a tournament like the Ontario Open with 1,800 competitors. It's pretty crazy. That tournament's probably bigger than half the tournaments in the United States, you know? So, our scene has grown so much. And I think from it growing like this, we get better athletes. So,
definitely. Oh yeah, like I would definitely say, like, the level of competition that we've seen over the years has just skyrocketed compared to, like, even from 2010 and then all the way up until now. Yeah. We're getting amazing tournaments, especially, like, we didn't have it this year, but even last year it was in Oshawa for the first time in that big what was that place called again? I don't even remember.
Oh, the Trillium Center where the Oshawa Generals play. Yeah, that's man, like, it was funny because that was funny. George Brito, I ran into George Brito at the tournament, and he goes, "Man, look at this. It looks like an IBJJF tournament." It's exactly what he said, and that he was right. It looked so big. It was like, you know, and that's, you know, if we could provide stuff like this for our members, man, how could you, you know, you can't get better than that. And you know, I credit Fernando Zulik for his hard work on trying to, you know, build the sport and make, you know, of course, yeah, he makes money, sure, but he earns it. And, you know, I think that, you know, he deserves every penny that he gets from his hard work. That's how I feel. And you know, I definitely credit him. And, you know, of course, he's no dummy. He sees stuff that he likes and he implements it. He learns. He's a quick learner, and he does everything he can to make his event, you know, as successful as it is, you know. So I give him a lot of credit for what he does.
I don't want to put you on the spot or anything like that, but do you feel, or optimistic at least, to say maybe we might have tournaments in 2021, or you're not sure yet?
Oh, in 2021, for sure.
Yeah.
The question is whether we'd be able to run provincials in December. That's the question. You know, it has everything to do with two things. Number one, how fast can we get through the phases? And then number two, how comfortable are people going to be with competing? That is the real question. So I've been speculating myself, and all I've been thinking is we'll be lucky if we can run a tournament in 2020. If we can get one in 2020, that would be astonishing. But that's me speaking. At the end of the day, it really has to do with how fast we recover. If we can get the gyms open, you know, in mid-July and things go great, we can get to phase two where the buddy system is working, you know, and then we get to phase three where we can, you know, start to do some real training. Who knows what can happen? At the end of the day, it has everything to do with how comfortable an individual is going to be with competing. And I'm sure there's going to be a handful of people. I can tell you this, like, my tournament on average brings in about 500 people. I think that I'll be lucky if I get 300. Mm-hmm. And that's not this September. That's a year from September.
Okay.
So I think we're going to be scaled back a little bit. I think, though, that once we can get two or three tournaments under our belt and then people start to see, hey, it's okay, then I think we're going to skyrocket and everything will blow up again. But because people want to compete, that's for sure. but I think that it's going to be a slow road when it comes to that. I think that people are going to be a little bit timid in that department. I think if we could maybe get some seminars in and you know, just because the seminars are going to get people together, right? The more opportunities we can get people together and see that there's no cases, I think that we're going to be better off.
Speaking of competition tournaments, what are some stories that stand out to you in your competition career, accolades?
For like me competing myself?
Yeah, man.
Obviously, you know, to this day, probably my biggest accomplishment was to go to Brazil and win that World Masters tournament that they had down there. They call it the International Masters and Seniors Tournament. But to us North Americans back then, it was our World Masters because there was no World Masters at the time. So if you wanted to be a world champion in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu at over 30, that was where you had to go. You had to go down to Brazil and fight in that tournament in the very infamous Tijuca Tennis Club, where they used to hold the World Championships, I believe, up until 1999.
I think they held it up there until about 2000. We're going to have to fact check this. I think 2004, 2005, and then I think they moved to the pyramid.
But, man, like I tell you, that building, man, it was to walk in there and think, man, this is where Hoyler won his 4 world titles, was in this building. You know, watching Marcelo Garcia do his magic was in this building. Then the amount of people that, you know, Hodger Gracie, like all the greats, you know, fought in that building. And here is little old me, brown belt me, fighting in this tournament. And, you know, in the semifinals and the finals, I had to fight Brazilians. So I was so nervous. I was kind of like, man, shit, this is what they do for a living. This is their, you know, I didn't realize that in Brazil, those guys, the recreational guys, man, to them, it's just fun. You know, they're not the hardcore competitive athletes that you thought they would be, right? They do have them, but, you know, the guys that I'm fighting in over 40, at the time I was fighting age 41 to 45, you know, a lot of those guys are just, you know, just the guys going to the gym, and to them, oh, it's just another tournament. Whereas to us North Americans, like, we're like, no, that's the fucking shit. That's the tournament, right? You go and you win that shit, and it's, you know, so the mentality of people that were coming from abroad was totally different than the Brazilians that were there. They were fighting. To them, it was just another tournament. It was no big deal because they have one every weekend there, you know. But to go there and win was, you know, yeah, it was pretty memorable for me. But yeah, that was probably the best memory I ever had. And of course, in 2013, I fought in my first World Masters tournament. And just the experience was great, you know. Going over to Portugal and fighting in the European Championships was really, really fun. I think the only regret I have was I never did a Pan American Championship. I wanted to do it, but, you know, the body's just saying, hey, no, you're not doing it. So every time that tournament was coming around, either I had something to do or I was injured. So I was kind of like, you know, why go to a tournament where you don't have no chance to win because you're all beat up, right? So, but man, like going to those tournaments to me was great. My jiu-jitsu career as a competitor, you know, I fought a lot as a white belt and a blue belt. And then, you know, my neck injury started to act up. So I kind of semi-retired, if you will. And then when I got my brown belt, I spent all that time as a purple belt, you know, not competing. So my body got to heal. And actually, I felt really good. And I was probably in the best shape of my life at the time. And they said, hey, let's go to Brazil and fight at the World Masters Tournament. And I was kind of like, let's wait a year. Let me actually break in this brown belt. And so I did that. But now walking away from that, I spent that whole year thinking in my head, I'm going to Brazil next year to fight at this tournament. I'm going to start training now. And I did. And I really, it was probably the best preparation for a competition I ever did. And when I got to Brazil to train at Gracie Humaitá in Brazil, the amount of great partners I had for the 10, 12 days that I was there was amazing. Like my first 3 days there, my training partner was Wellington Megaton Diaz. And he was so generally nice guy, but man, like what a partner to have for your training, you know. It was like, It was pretty amazing. Yeah, for those of you who don't know, that's Mackenzie Dern's, you know, father. So, I mean, you know, and being there and watching Mackenzie train, and you had Chrome Gracie there and Solo Ribeiro there. You had some, like, killers, Fredson Alves. You know, these guys, these were the people I was training with every day. It was pretty, you know, it was pretty amazing to watch, you know. Rodrigo Mundaruca, of course, and, you know, some great stories at that competition. Megatons fighting a guy in the tournament, and he catches the guy in an arm lock and breaks the guy's arm. And he's got the guy's arm in, you know, just a regular arm bar, and he's saying to the ref, you know, his arm is broken like this, right? And the referee says to the guy, are you okay? And the guy uses his free arm and says, yeah, good, thumbs up, thumbs up. And Megaton's like, whatever. And, you know, so he's still like this. And then he starts to move his hips like this, trying to show the ref, look, his arm is broken. And the guy pops up onto his feet and ends up in Megaton's guard. And Megaton balloon sweeps him. And the guy does this beautiful cartwheel to avoid landing on his back. But then when he lands on his one knee and his foot, he puts the broken arm back to support himself. And you just see the arm like this, right? And now the guy's down, and you can see Megaton arguing with that. I told you his arm was broken. Just the craziest thing I ever saw, you know. And then you have Saulo Ribeiro in his first fight. So his first fight, he beats the guy in like a minute and a half or whatever, submits the guy, and he walks off the mat, starts putting on his sandals, and he's speaking to somebody in Portuguese. And I guess what he realized was the guy that he was supposed to fight next actually got a bye in the first round, so he was fresh. So Saulo says, you know what, just get him out here, let's go. And kicks his sandals back off, walks right back on the mat, like he barely left. Walked right back onto the mat, and the guy who got the bye jumps out there and fights him. Saulo finishes that guy, and then the guy has the gall to ask him for a selfie on the mat, and Saulo's like, sure, whatever, and takes a picture with this guy who just beat him. Like, and I was like, the whole place was just freaking out because they saw what was going on. Like, you know, like Saulo wants no rest. He's just, you know, give me another guy.
Mowing down the division. Like,
oh, it was just, it was amazing to watch.
All right, bring on the next guy. He submits him. Okay, bring on the next guy.
Yeah. I was like, wow, you know, watching that was probably really, really cool, you know. You know, a lot of people can say what they want about Saulo Ribeiro. He is one hell of a competitor, man. He really is. And when it comes to jiu-jitsu, he knows his shit. You know, he's really, really, and, you know, he commands that, you know, confidence. You know, he's that type of a guy, and that's not a bad thing, you know. But yeah, Brazil is probably my best experience for sure. You know, I've had a lot of opportunities to fight Fernando Zulik here in Ontario, and those are some of my best matches and some of my best experiences because you know, we got to go out there and have fun, you know. You know, I got to fight a guy I idolized. You know, the guy was a black belt when I was a white belt, and here I am, you know, a decade later fighting him in the black belt division in Wagner Fabiano. And I was like, you know, that's a funny story because I was Master 4. So I shouldn't even have been there. But I moved down to Master 3 so I could fight Fernando. And then on the last day of registration, lo and behold, doesn't Wagner Fabiano register in the lightweight division? So he's, you know, he's not in our weight class. So me and Fernando are in like medium heavy and he's in lightweight. And yeah, I'm like, okay, you know, Fernando and I will fight in our weight class. And then, you know, I'm going to bow out because I'm not going to do the absolute. And, you know, Fernando could fight Wagner in the absolute. And then sure enough, I fucking get up in the, I guess it's Friday morning, I guess I wake up. And so all the last changes need to be made by then. And I get up and I look and fucking Wagner Fabiano is in medium heavy with us. And I'm like, and my response when I saw it was, holy shit, like this. And my wife's like, what? I go, Wagner Fabiano's in my division like this. I was like, it was yelled with fear. I was like, holy fuck.
So you were partly fanboy, partly shitting yourself. Was that?
Yeah. I was like, oh no, I'm going to get killed. I'm just going to get killed. Right? That's all I'm thinking. Right? I'm like, wow. Right. But I mean, it was you know, it was a great experience. He ended up arm locking me, and I've only been submitted twice in at black belt, and Wagney is one of them. And the very first time I ever fought Fernando, he triangled me. But I mean,
what's your current record against Fernando right now? Like 0-28?
Oh, 0-5, I think. 0-5. I do much better when we train together than we compete, but
sure you do.
I think the time that I retired, but the year before that, when I lost to Wagney, I fought Fernando to like a 0-0 draw. He won a referee's decision, and you know, rightfully so. I thought he should have won it, but you know, that was probably the best I ever did to him. Was I lost by a referee's decision, but you know. Yeah, man, like Fernando is, you know, quite the competitor. He understands the right time to go and, you know, whatnot. And you know, he got the better of me, you know. I don't really like to make excuses and whatnot. But, you know, because of my neck surgery, there was a lot of things I just couldn't do. But I didn't let that be a reason for me not to compete. So I was always up against it. There's a lot of dexterity that I don't have with my legs. Like, I guess to give you an example, like if I'm in half guard, you know, for me to take my free leg and butterfly hook your thigh, you know, I'd have to like reach down and grab my shin and put it in there. I don't have the dexterity to put it in myself.
And a lot of that I think is due to like the nerve damage from your neck going.
Yeah.
Down.
So I have a lot of nerve damage. So
control of.
Yeah. So like, you know, as you guys know, as jiu-jitsu players, you know, that's taken away from you. Yeah, man, it makes things a little difficult for you to compete, but you learn how to live with it, but you know, it does put you at a disadvantage. So I've been, you know, fortunate to be able to go out there and compete and win some and lose some, and knowing that I had these issues. And, you know, when you go out there and watch, nobody knows, nobody knows the difference or whatever. It's funny when you see me get up from winning gold in Brazil, you could see the way I'm walking. You could see that I have like a, you know, some nerve damage by the way you see me walking. And I'm kind of like, when I watch it, I kind of laugh at myself, but it's a reality. So, you know, I'm happy to go out there. I still, you know, train, you know, and I don't pull my punches. I do the best I can. And you know, whatever happens, happens. I think that jiu-jitsu is such a learning experience that you can't turn around and say, oh, because I have this, I can't do that. Like, no, man, just go out there and have fun. And, it's not if you lose, you're going to die. So it's no big deal for me. It's a learning experience every time I'm out there, whether I'm competing or if Mike is just beating me up, it doesn't really matter. I just, you know, want to be able to go out there and have fun and just, you know, train. Right.
You've never beat me up or come on.
No, I said, you beat me up.
He was complimenting you.
Tony always beats me up. What are you talking about?
I try.
So, Tony, how did you get involved in the Canadian Jiu-Jitsu team?
I don't know if you remember back in 2017, we lost our ability to run competition. And one of the reasons for that was that we were not aligned with the international sport organization for our sports, which is Jiu-Jitsu. So, you know. There was an organization called the Jiu-Jitsu International Federation, and they're recognized by the IOC for Jiu-Jitsu. And when we say Jiu-Jitsu, we're talking all types of Jiu-Jitsu. They've been around for the longest time, but they took on what we recognize as Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu back in 2013. We were not aware of this, but they did. And they made it part of their curriculum. So, and they really, you know, they just adopted the IBJJF rules. So what they were doing is exactly what we were doing. But we weren't made aware of this, and we didn't really investigate into this until the government turned around and said, hey, you guys had long enough time to get affiliated with an ISO. You know, I'm sorry, we're going to have to take your accreditation away. And so they did. And so we scrambled to get recognized by this organization. And it was a lot of work, a lot of emailing and trying to contact people. And I think what really did it was, they, I would go onto their website and I would see all the events that they were doing. And the most of them are in Europe. It's really big over there in Europe. And what I did see was a world championship. And the Canadian Federation that was recognized by them was very they were inactive. They weren't sending any athletes. And then, so years back, they contacted, or we contacted them, and they told us to get in touch with the Canadian Federation that they recognize. And when we contacted them, they basically told us to get lost. They wanted nothing to do with us. But really, they was like one or two people. It was like two people, and they had no athletes. Like, they weren't doing anything. They would show up at the World Championships and, you know, just drink beer with all the other delegates. Like, they never really sent athletes. So we contacted them and said, hey, look, you know, we want to be a part of your association. You know, can we be a part of your association? And they were like, no, get lost. Right. So we went back to the International Federation and said, this guy doesn't want to work with us and yada, yada, yada. And I said, no, you got to go with them. And it was like this, you know, this running around in circles. Right. So we got the government involved, got the government to try to talk to them. And they told the government to get lost. So that's when we realized, okay, this is a dead end. Right. And so we let it drop for like a year. This was before they took it away. So we were dealing with these people beforehand. But then when the government took it away from us, now we went back and contacted them. When we went back and contacted them, they had kicked out the Canadian Federation because they were inactive. They weren't sending any athletes. Right. So we were like, whoa, so you're telling me the door is open? And they're like, yeah, the door is open. You know, we got to do this and that and all these other things. And we're like, okay. So we were having all these, you know, email discussions with them, and the things started to fall away, and like, they weren't answering us and all this stuff. And I sent one email that changed everything. And I said, you know, we would really like to come and send a team to your world championships, but we can't do that if you don't recognize us. And the very next day I got an email back saying, whoa, wait a second, you guys can send a team? And we're like, yeah, we'll send a full Nawaza team. That's what they called Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. We'll send a full Nawaza team down there and kick all your asses. It's kind of like the attitude I had was, but we can't do that if you don't, you know. So they're like, okay, I'm going to send you credentials and you register your team. I'm like, okay, that sounds cool. So at the time, this was 2017, the event was going to happen, and it was in Bogota, Colombia. So you know, the OJA has a lot of money, and we were like, kind of like, so this is the situation. If we can send a team down there to represent Canada, they'll green light us to be the recognized organization for jiu-jitsu in Canada, which would mean we can go back to our Ontario government and say, look, we're recognized by the JJIF. Give us our credentials back to run tournaments in Canada, in Ontario, right? And so we went and we did all this, and we went down with, I think, 11 athletes. Yeah, 11 athletes. No, sorry. I think we went down with five girls. Yeah, five girls and six guys, 11 athletes we went down with. We came back, I think, the first year with five medals. Yeah, we came back with five medals, two gold, a silver, and two bronze. And we won best new team, best new country at the tournament, which, you know, for me was a big deal because, you know, I really wanted to go down there and do well, right? And we wowed everybody. Like, Team Poland goes, like, where the hell did you guys come from, right? Because Poland had a pretty good team. Russia was okay, but they weren't a very strong team because of where the tournament was being held. So a lot of the European countries didn't bring massive teams because it was in South America, right? But Poland had a big team there. They have total government funding in Poland for their team. So they sent a full team down, and we just, every time we faced a Polish guy, we just mopped the floor with them. And they couldn't believe it because, you know, they were pretty strong, but they were dealing with Sheehan and they were dealing with Nate Dos Santos, and the girls had to go through Alison Trombley. Like, good luck. You know, it was like really, you know, it was really a perfect time for Canada because, you know, we really showed them. And then when we went back the next year, it was in Sweden. Everybody was gunning for us. They were like, oh, this Canadian team, they're no joke, right? They're really good. And I was like, shit, man, you wait till USA comes here with a real team. You guys are going to be really in trouble, you know? And, but having said that, that was how we got our foot in the door to bring jiu-jitsu back here in Ontario, and which, you know, I think we were down for a total of 6 months. I think they took it away from us July of 2017, and we were back up in January 2018. So, you know, it's not
I remember that.
Yeah, it was a rough time for us, but it ended up going okay for us, you know.
So especially like when you look at like places like Quebec that still can't have tournaments, is that based off that same legislation that went through, or is this something completely different that they can't get around now?
Hold on a second. I lost you guys for a second there.
You alive?
Yeah. Yeah. No, you know what? Quebec is kind of a different animal. I'm not really sure. And it's funny, I just having a conversation with Fabio Holanda, who lives out there, and I said to him, what's going on with Quebec? And he's like, no fucking clue. There is an organization out there that's trying to help get it back together, but I think Quebec really just doesn't know what they want to do. I've heard some words, some talk about them wanting to treat it like a commission sport, which I think is a really bad idea. You know, like run it under the athletics commission.
It's interesting, actually,
which is how they run pro sport.
What would be the difference between, for those listening, like a commission sport and what the OJA is doing or the CJA or?
Well, a commission sport, it's totally run by the government. So the government's making all that money instead of the sport. You know, why is the government getting involved? And the government's not going to train officials. They're not going to do any of this. They're just going to say, here, give us your money. Okay, run your tournament. What rules are you going to use? Whatever rules you use.
You don't want a government official running, sanctioned tournaments at all.
No, man. Like, it's – they know nothing about what we do, but they want to turn around and tell us how to do it. That makes no sense at all to me.
Oh, absolutely. And
financially, how does the sport grow and make money? Like, could you imagine if they said that judo is going to be run by the government now, not Judo Quebec? They'd be like, are you fucking crazy? How are we supposed to make money to send athletes to Olympics? That's exactly what they would say. But with our sport, that's what they want to do. And when I say to the guys, do you want me to talk to the government people in Quebec? They're like, oh, yeah, we'll take care of it. And here we are. That was when 2017, and they still can't do tournaments in Quebec. Mm-hmm. So I've gotten to the point where I'm like, you know what? I'll let them deal with it. It's not my concern. I got tournaments here in Ontario. That's all I'm worried about. You know,
yeah, let the Quebecers figure it out.
Get your shit together, Quebec.
To be honest with you, the
entire province.
If I were to go over there and try to do it, they'd be, what's with these Ontario guys coming over here? And so it's best that I just stay out of it and let them figure it out. If they want to get a green light for their organization from the Canadian Jiu-Jitsu Association, I'll gladly do it. But you know, they got to reach out to us. I'm not reaching out to them anymore.
No, you just let them do it. Like, if they don't want Ontario's help, leave them alone.
Yeah, it is what it is. But if they go the commission way, they're only shooting themselves in the foot, man. They're giving all that money away to the government. That's how I see it. So,
it'd be a fucking gong show.
Yeah. You know.
So, let me ask you this. So, Sub X, where did Sub X come out of then?
So, I had an old colleague of mine that used to run super fight shows, a guy named Ricardo Amendola. He used to run an event called the Ontario Submission Wrestling Invitational, and you know, it was a pretty good show. He used to have guys like, you know, he had Fabio Holanda fight Jeff Jocelyn on that show. He had Spider DiCenzo fought Fabio Holanda. He had George St. Pierre on the card 1 year. You know, some really good fights at the time. It was, you know, it was kind of like the show everybody wanted to go watch because it involved a lot of the local guys. And the problem was, you know, Ricardo wasn't really making any money. And I guess that's what he wanted. He wanted to make money. And so he decided he wasn't going to do
it. Don't we all, Tony? Don't we all?
Yeah, sure we do. It's nice, but I think it's not a bad thing to have a platform for our athletes to go out there and compete. And if you can make it happen and it's not killing you, you know, why not, right? So, I mean, I don't make a lot of money when I do the Sub-X, but, you know, if I can put a good card together, I'm doing it. I don't care because I think more than the money, what I enjoy is to see everybody enjoy the event. You know, I want to see people, like, really like it. I like it when people come and say, hey, Tony, man, that was a great show. You know, like, I like that. And it makes me want to do it again. You know what I mean? So, yeah, it'd be nice if I can make 20 grand, but it's not reality. So, I mean, to go out there and just put on a show that everybody enjoys, you know, that's my money right there to me. So what happened was he stopped doing the show. And that's what really birthed the Canadian Submission Expo. I think the first couple of years, it wasn't that great an event. I did it out of a high school and it picked up steam. It got a little bit better each year. And then I think one year I went for broke and I brought in 4-time world champion, Rubens Cobrinha Charles to fight on the card. And, at the time he was like the reigning world champion. He was like, you know, the best guy in the world at featherweight. And, I brought him in to fight Shane Rice, who was a Hicks and Gracie black belt out of the East Coast. And the place was packed. It was jam packed. And it was an amazing show. It was really an amazing show. And ever since then, that put the show on the map, of course. So I've had, you know, quite a handful of shows since. I usually try to run like one a year you know, some of them are really successful. Some are not so successful. But, you know, I do everything all by myself. I don't have, you know, a lot of help. I got the help of, you know, Jeremy and Lonnie who come and help me backstage on event day and stuff like that. But, you know, everything from, you know, the fight card posters to everything, I do it all myself. So it's not like a huge production that, you know, some people have the ability to do. So, you know, so I'm up against it every time I do a show. And the biggest fear I have is, you know, making sure I have a good card, you know. So, I mean, it's something I love to do. It's any time that I can put a card together, I will definitely run a show. You know, I'm always getting, you know, the local guys. I had Monkey on my last show fight a guy from Quebec. You know, Justin Bruckman just recently came to me, Tony, and said, Tony, I'm ready. I'm like, ready for what, right? And he's like, I'm ready to put me on the show, man. I want to fight. I don't care who it is. As long as he's just old like me, just put me in the card, man. I'm ready to go. And he goes, just give me some time. Let me know when you're going to do the show so I can prepare. And I'm thinking, fuck, I would love to have Justin Bruckman on my show because, you know, he's so popular in the community. And you know, it's a funny story because I just before this COVID happened, on March the 8th, I believe, there was an MMA show in Toronto. And George Brito fought on the card. And just because George Brito fought on the card, Matthew and I bought tickets and we went to go watch because, you know, I want to support him. And of course, Justin was there. He had a fighter on the card. And him and I were sitting back just before George was getting ready to go in the cage. And Justin was like, man, I'm just so proud to watch this guy go in there to fight at the age that he's at. It makes me feel I can still do it. You know, it really brought memories back to Justin. As you guys know, Justin was the former UCC MMA champion. He lost the title to George St. Pierre. So, I mean, you know, he's a icon in MMA here in Canada. And for him to sit back and watch George and have it, you know, influence him in the way it did is kind of a big deal, you know. So to see him turn around and say to me, yeah, man, put me on the show, put me in, coach, I'm ready to go. I was like, wow, that's pretty awesome, you know. So I will always try to put a show together every year. I'm not going to be crazy and try to do 4 or 5 shows. I'm just too busy of a person to do that. You know, it'd be nice if I could do them if they were successful, but you know, the reality is just, I think that if, to do really, really good, I got to put more energy into it and I just don't have the energy to do it. So if I can do one a year, just put one pack card a year and then have everybody look forward to next year, I'm good with that. You know?
What are some of your favorites Sub-X matches that you've witnessed during the years? And please don't say Michael Breyer's getting triangled with his arm and leg in.
I'm going to be honest with you. One of my memorable matches is probably at the time was between two white belts. One of the names you guys all know, the other guy is like virtually unknown. But at the time, they were two white belts. It was Cash Matty from Lynn Martial Arts and from Extreme Couture, Mike Imperato.
Oh, yeah.
It was the first fight of the night on the card. And there was so many mistakes in this fight, but it was the most exciting fight I have ever seen. I would have to say the submission rate was happening. Every 10 seconds, one of those two guys were caught in a submission. And they would get out. Every 10 seconds, the guy was caught in a submission. And then the guy would get out. And all of a sudden, the guy would get swept. And then he was in it. It was just so crazy. It was like when the match was over, it was a standing ovation. And it was more so because they were two white belts. And it was a no-gi match, so you didn't really know that. But everybody got up and just was like, holy shit, what a match. And I was giving away awards for Fight of the Night. And the first thing I said was, and that was on the Cabrinha card. And I was like, ain't nobody gonna top that. And that was match one. And I was like, I don't think there's another match that's gonna top that tonight. And I was like, wow. So I gave them both like $50 and said, here, man, like, congratulations, Fight of the Night. Like it was pretty awesome, you know? And I credit Mike Imperato on that because, man, he sold like 40 tickets. For that show, and you know, it was pretty awesome performance that he put out there. He was backstage, you know, all upset with himself, crying because he thought he didn't do a really good job. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, that was such an amazing performance. Like, I was like, wow, dude, like, you have nothing to be ashamed of. That was amazing. And it ended up being a draw, and he was mad because he didn't get the sub. And I was like, dude, you have nothing to be mad about. That was an awesome fight, you know. But yeah, that was probably my most memorable. Getting George Brito on the card was a big deal. I had him fight on the card, I think, in 2009. And he fought a guy named Josh Russell from out of Alberta.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and Josh Russell outweighed him by like 15 pounds or something like that. And George put on a clinic. He beat the guy 4-0. And, you know, it was another great match. And it was pretty loud and crazy because, of course, with George Brito on the card, the place was filled with Toronto BJJ. Fans, of course, and so that place was really, really loud. But yeah, that was one of my memorable fights as well, to see him, you know, prevail. And it was funny too because I was a little disappointed with Josh being overweight. And mind you, he was traveling. He traveled from Alberta to California for something, and then from California he flew right here just for the fight. You know, he was kind of like doing me a favor. He didn't take a penny to fight on the card, you know, so he came in and he was like, he was supposed to be 170. He ended up being 183. You know, I went backstage to George and I said, you know, he's overweight. And he goes, it's okay. He's here. Let's do it. You know, you know, he fought and, you know, fought a great match. So, I mean, that was one of my memorable fights as well. Man, there's been so many others that over the years that I really enjoyed, but there's just been so many I can't remember, but those two stick out in my mind more than anything else, for sure.
When you see
– sorry, go ahead,
Aaron. Sorry to interrupt, Mike. When you start to see, like, new formats, like the Quintex and all that kind of stuff, does that kind of, like, make you kind of want to, okay, how can I jam-pack this next card just to, like, so you have those levels of excitement, or you're just like,
I love what Rory is doing. I think that he's giving a demographic. If you're asking me if I'm going to change what I'm doing, probably not. But I just think the room for all these different types of shows is a great thing. I think that is awesome. And you know, if an athlete would prefer to do one over the other, man, that's their preference. But I think that if I were to try to change what I was doing to mimic what he's doing, it just looks like I'm copying him. I like the fact that guys can go and fight for 10 minutes. And if nobody wins, it's a draw. There's no loser. You know, of course, there's no winner either. But there's no loser. These guys are both great athletes, and you know, they performed well. I think, should there be rules to make them want to fight more? Sure. I like that idea. But I also like the idea of having no points, no advantages, just go for the finish. And if you can't get the finish, hey, man, shake hands and move on. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think for the fans, the idea here is for them to go out there and put on a show for those fans. And, you know, I think to take the points away where, you know, if they go after something and if they fail, they don't have to worry about giving up a guard pass. You know what I mean? It'll make them go after stuff more, I think, by having no points. So, you know, I like, again, like I said, I'm loving how everybody is enjoying what Rory is doing, because it is definitely new and it's different. But I want Rory to keep that. I want that to be his baby and let him run those shows. And if he can run 4 or 5 shows a year with that, you know, style, you know, I will say this as a promoter putting on shows. It's hard to do this because now you're not dealing with one athlete against one athlete. You got to find a team that's willing to put a team in there. And, yeah. And as you guys know, with BJJ, there's egos, you know. And if I'm a smaller team, I don't want to have to go up against Gringo Jiu-Jitsu and all of his Brazilians, you know. So they will, you know, it's going to be hard. I think that I'm happy that Rory is getting the teams to come out and do as they do. But I just think as more shows go on, he's going to have a harder time, like, you know, getting guys to fight, you know, because, you know, they don't want to lose. And, you know, that's a stigma that's been around forever, you know? So, I mean, you know, you have the odd athlete who doesn't give a shit and will just go out there and put it on the line. And I pat them all on the back for it, because those are the people that we want to see on the shows. I don't care about the guy who wants to win by an advantage. I want to see the guy who's going to go for it, you know? And if he loses, he just goes, well, it's just a fight, you know? And, you know, that's the attitude I'm looking for when I look to put cards together. And, you know, that I've passed up a lot of people from my show just because it's not what I'm looking for, you know?
In your opinion, what needs to be done to kind of elevate jiu-jitsu kind of the next level, like taking it from something amateur to something professional? Like, you see a lot of, like, you know, fight to win shows and things like that in the U.S. What needs to be done to kind of elevate things even more and take them to the next level?
You mean from a promoter's perspective?
From a promoter's perspective, maybe from an athlete perspective.
I think that, we need to have an opportunity for athletes to fight under a professional mindset or rule set or government standard or whatever you want to call it. For the most part, these shows that we do are amateur. So because they're amateur, they got to follow the rules that we have, which means you can't do things like heel hooks and slamming each other and whatnot. You know, we've kind of bent the rules a little bit, whereas in Rory's show, we've been allowing, you know, reaping of the knee in the competitions. We've been allowed to get away with that. I don't think we'd be able to get away with heel hooks in the competitions. However, if we can get the government to give us a professional status for jiu-jitsu, in addition to the amateur status, then a guy like Rory can do a pro show where it's commissioned and he could do heel hooks. He could do.
We need to get heel hooks. Hashtag all submissions matter.
We'll be able to do heel hooks. We'll be able to do twisters. We'll be able to do, you know, all those things under a professional guideline, because pro rules, of course, are going to be different. It's hard to be able to say to a government that we're going to allow a technique that we don't allow at the world championships. It doesn't make sense. And the government's not going to back you on it. You know what I mean? So I think in order to make something like this happen is we need to create a professional status for jiu-jitsu within Ontario and Canada for that matter. And be able to have pro shows like Fight to Win, and then Fight to Win can come here and do their shows. You know what I mean? So, that would be a nice way to, I think that's the way it needs to be done. Whether the government agrees with it or not is the problem. So
what are the steps to like get it to be a pro sport? Is it more, is it a money thing? Is it a government legislation thing, or is it just,
I haven't really looked into it. I'm probably gonna, Rory just recently jumped on our board. I'm probably going to have Rory look into that and see how we can, you know, make it work. I don't think it make it work on an amateur level. But if we can find a way to get a professional jiu-jitsu here, that's definitely would be it. And then we could even do things like pro-ams where we have, you know, pro rules and amateur rules for, you know, on the same show, you know, it would be kind of cool like that. I really think in order to get to the next level of submission levels in our sport, I think that it needs to be done at a professional level, to be honest. And not only that, but then, you know, it makes sense to pay the fighters and you know, all those other things because it's pro sport, right? So, that's my opinion. I think that's how it should be done, but, you know, everybody has their own opinion on how it should be done, right?
To wrap up, I wanted to ask you, you have some infamous stories and altercations that have happened maybe in the 90s, would you say? I think, how old were you then, 40?
No, let's just say in my 20s, I was a young guy seeking greatness in my abilities. You know, I hadn't found jiu-jitsu yet. I was a kickboxer, and I got into the occasional scrap at a bar, if you will. But
occasional.
At least once a month. But what I mean,
you were testing your skills, right?
I literally, that's what I was doing, and you know. You know, at the end of the day, you always want to find out if what you're learning in the gym is going to work out on the street, right? And, you know, you have to remember this. When I was a kickboxer in the 90s and whatnot, I started around 130 pounds and I probably, you know, peaked at around 150 pounds. I wasn't a very big guy. I was very small, but, you know, I was quite agile and, you know, I was an adequate fighter, if you will. But compared to the guys in the street, I was a superstar because they didn't know really how to fight. You know, a lot of real pure martial artists would hate me for the things I did, because I was that young punk who, you know, took advantage of my abilities against guys who just didn't have the training I had. But mind you, I was, you know, to be fair, I was picking the resident asshole of the bar, you know, so, you know, I didn't feel like I was doing a total disjustice, if you will, but, you know, being older and wiser now, I do see that a lot of those things I did when I was younger was, you know, not cool, totally not cool, but, it was fun doing it at the time for sure. I did have my fair level of scraps, but, some funny stories. I'm sure Mike, you remember a lot of them, but, I had rules, you know, when I would go to a bar, to not drink a lot because, you know, I just might get in a fight. So,
there was a code.
Yeah. At 148 pounds, I usually sized up to everybody in the bar as smaller. So, you know, when you tell a guy to fuck off and you're half their size, they're probably not going to go away. So, you know, I usually had to, you know, drop them. So I created that reputation in Rexdale for, you know, getting into fights in bars. But
shout out to Rexdale.
Yeah. Yeah. I grew up in the Rexdale area. And, my first martial art gym was right in the heart of Jamestown Crescent. And which was a really bad area in the West End. And, you know, so peeps out to the Jamestown peeps that used to train with me. And, you know, for sure it was, the mentality was definitely different back then. And I didn't have to worry about, you know, guns. You know, the odd knife did come around, but, you really didn't worry about weapons back in the 90s, you know, and, whereas today it's just a totally different cup of tea. And, the the people aren't really thinking with a level head. They're not thinking about tomorrow at all. And you know, when you do that, you do some really stupid, stupid stuff. So it's, I don't condone people to do what I did in the 90s, because we're in 2020 now, and you know, you might beat that guy up today, but tomorrow he's going to shoot you. And, you know, that's not fun for anybody. At the end of the day, you want to be here to and celebrate life with your friends and your family. And you can't do that if you're just not here. So sometimes you got to pick and choose when is the right time for you to have to defend yourself. And, you know, yeah, I've learned over the years that, you know, sometimes it's not a good time to fight. And, you know, it's just when I was younger, that just didn't happen. You know?
No, I love it. Well, listen, yeah. And again, amazing, wise advice for the next generation, and obviously from learning from you and all that kind of stuff. I do want to thank you very much for coming on the show today. I want to give you the opportunity to close us out. Anything you want to say, any advice you want to give?
I want to wrap. Let me shout out some people who influenced me and helped me for sure. First and foremost, I want to do a shout out to Danny's brother, Sil Maroney, who was my first BJJ coach. And probably because of him, kept me in the game, because he was such a good teacher and I learned a lot from him. And I try to emulate him when I teach, because I learned so much from him. So of course, Dan Maroney, who gives me the opportunity to do jujitsu every day and you know, helps me with the knowledge of everything that I know. Of course, Fighters Market, Bruno Mandaruca, Jeff Santos. I've been outfitted from those guys, you know, pretty much the whole end of my jiu-jitsu career. And you know, they never asked anything from me except to be their friend. And, you know, in return, I push Fighters Market and King's Kimonos wholeheartedly. To this day, you know, I haven't competed in over 2 years, and I wear nothing but Kings. That's what I'm going to wear till the day I die. And that's just because I want to support the people who support me. So, you know, for sure, this jiu-jitsu community is a great community. They do have a certain level of people that are characters, but at the end of the day, I think that that's a part of the community to make it healthy. So for everybody who's a part of the community and just wants to see jiu-jitsu get better, hey man, keep what you're doing, because you're helping all of us. So, you know.
Future of the sport, Tony Isaacs, thank you for coming on tonight.
All right, brothers.
Thank you guys. Really appreciate it. Thank you, Tony, so much.
All right, you guys take care.
You take care. Choking Hazard all 2020, right. Sponsored by nobody.
Bye, everybody.
All right, guys. Cheers.